bomb a 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 dang a dang dang a ding a dong.
Blue moon, blue moon, you saw me standing alone.
Hello and welcome back to the Railway Men podcast. We're back with the latest of our ex-player interviews. I'm joined as ever by two of our regular panelists to jump in whenever they feel like I've missed something. Today we have Aaron and Tim. How are you guys?
Hi, all right.
Yeah, good. Our guest for today then is a former captain, someone with two Wembley wins for Crewe. And most importantly, he was one half of the Alex's first ever YouTube channel. It's none other than Matt Tootle. Hi, Matt.
Hello. You all right?
Yeah, good. Thanks for coming on.
No, thanks for having me. I've been really looking forward to it, actually. So let's get cracking.
Excellent. Okay, let's get cracking then. So We'll start at the beginning. Now, you're from Widnes, I believe, which is just down the Mersey River from Liverpool.
How early
do you remember there being football in your life? What age do you realise you're actually quite good at football?
So I've got one brother who's older, and I kind of followed him. So whatever he done, I done. And I got to about seven and I'd never kicked the ball. And my mum used to go mad at us for sitting in the house playing on computer games and she'd say, get out the house, go and do something, go and play. And then my brother just one day come to me at dinner time at school and said, oh, I'm playing football with like my mates at school. And he used to, I love him to bits for it, but he used to always involve me in whatever he'd done and he weren't embarrassed of me. So he was like, why don't you go and play with us? So I went playing with these year, I think they were year five or six at the time. And I'd never kicked a ball in my life. And literally for this first dinner time I'd ever played football, I was taking the mick out of everyone. Once the ball was at my feet, I knew what to do. It was mad. So from that moment then, I must have been, I don't know what year three is. What's year three? Like nine or 10? No, eight, seven, I don't know. But it's, I think it was about seven-ish, something like that.
Yeah, seven, eight-ish.
Yeah, so from then I fell in love with it. So first moment the ball hit my foot, I was just like, this is what I'm meant to do. This is my future. This is my dream, like, straight away. And quite quickly, I ended up playing the year six team at year three and doing really well. And then my brother signed for a team. So I signed for the same team at a lower age level. And from then, really, yeah, that was it. And I really just... you know what? The maddest thing about it, and I mean this, Howard, that's the last time I would say I really loved football. I would say from between 7 and 10, it was the last time I really, really like loved playing football and loved the game for it, what it was, if you know what I mean. Because as soon as you go, so I'm jumping a few steps, but I went to Liverpool then for about 6 weeks, and straight away it was like, It weren't just playing football anymore. It was serious, and it was, you've got to do this and you can't do that, and you've got to play like this and you have to do that. And I kind of come to the end of it and I got told that I wasn't getting kept on, but it was a strange one. I got a little bit bullied at Liverpool by the lads and obviously Scousers, and I'm not actually a Scouser, I'm just from outside Liverpool, obviously, like you said, from Widnes, and Dougie would tell you that I'm not a Scouser. Like, he hated it when anyone said I was a Scouser.
You're a wall, aren't you, Matt?
I'm a wall, yeah. I'm a woolly back. And so anyone from outside of Liverpool, if you're not from Liverpool, but, you know, you still speak like a Liverpoolian, and then you get called a wall. So I'm a wall. So, yeah, that Liverpool didn't go well. And then I said to my mum, I said, I'm not going to an academy ever again. I'm not doing it. And it went on a long time where Crewe, Terry McPhillips, remember Terry Mac, and Paul Bennett, another one, were just coming to my game every single, I don't know what they were doing at the club at the time, but they weren't working for Crewe because it was just at my games. Whenever I had a game, they were there. Like, and I was thinking, why don't you go and do something at Crewe? Because he's just watching me. And after every game, every time, it was, will you come to Crewe? And I was just, no, it's not happening, no. I didn't like the pressure. I didn't like the fact that all the lads knew that I was coming in to maybe take the place. And you look at my problems I've had in that I've spoke out about, and I think back to when I was 10, 11, and I think, you know what, I should have known that these kind of problems were going to happen because I was just too scared to kind of go somewhere and not do well, if you know what I mean. It was really, really important to me that I didn't go somewhere again and not do well and not enjoy it. So, yeah, that's how it kind of all started. And then for some reason, I think, if I remember rightly, and this is going real into real deep, like detail, but I had a lesson at school in year six or something. And what it was we had to write down what we wanted to do when we grew up. And I was still just playing Sunday league football, Saturday league football. And at that time, I was a goal scoring midfielder. So I was playing like just in behind a striker. And I used to score 35, 40 goals a season. And you won't believe that, obviously. You all watched me when I was at crew. And
was it three goals in your crew career, Matt?
It was Rochdale, Leighton Orient, Barnsley. I think that's it. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. No, one more. Just one more in the cup, I think. I can't remember. It might be three or four. Yeah, it weren't a lot. Like,
yeah.
But, and I should, do you know what? The funniest thing is about it is I think if you went back all my games with crew, the chances I had to score goals, like, it would have been 25, 30. I had some unbelievable chances that I just, absolute panic, like squeaky bum moment when I got in on goal, and it was like, oh my god, I'm gonna score! Like, and then it was like, I'd missed the target or whatever. But yeah, so I was this goal scoring midfielder, and I think that obviously is what attracted Terry and to come in. And I wrote this essay down at school or whatever, and I started trying in school because I was like, if I'm gonna be a footballer, I've got to go to an academy, and I've got to do that. Do you know what I mean? And it's like I made a big decision at the age of 10, 11 of right, I've got to put my big boy pants on, and I've got to go and try this. Because if I'm going to do this, I've got to kind of really, you know, be brave. Because it was a brave thing for me to do, because I was always really nervous and kind of a performance anxiety kind of player, like with Woody before games and stuff. But only when I went to academies, when I was on a Sunday league, I knew that I was the best player. So I turned up excited because I knew that I was going to show everyone how good I was. There was no pressure on it kind of thing. So yeah, I come home and I told my mum, I said, I wanted to ring crew and tell them I want to go. And that was it. That was it. Then I came to crew.
Excellent.
So best decision I ever made. Yeah.
So there was only crew really involved at that stage then. Once you'd sort of gone to Liverpool, that didn't work out. It was only crew that was after your professional.
No, Everton wanted me to go Wolves, Tranmere, obviously, Tranmere, but I was never going to Tranmere. There was about four or five teams, but because of how crew were with me and they kept saying to me, like, because I told them, I said to Terry Mack and Benno, I said, if I'm going to come, if I get bullied or for 1 minute I feel like uncomfortable, I'm going to walk away from it. I'm not, because I've had it before and I'm not having it again. Like, and they were like, yeah, don't worry about that. And then I went on to say that you might not remember a couple of the players who I reel off to you now, but so my first day at crew was down at Shavington.
Yeah.
That bloody AstroTurf down there, I tell you, come on leaps and bounds now, but I don't know how we used to play football on that. The grass burns you used to get, the Astro burns, yeah. Bloody hell. So I turned up anyway, and a lad called Matt Lund, who went to Stoke.
Yeah, he's at Bristol Rovers, scored against us this season.
Rochdale.
Is he at Rochdale now, yeah? He scored two, didn't he, against us? Yeah, I've seen that, and I thought, bloody hell, because I haven't spoken to Matt for a while, but I thought he'll be made up with that, because I think there was a bit of stuff said to him when he left or whatever. But I walked in, and I've not met any of the lads, and Matt Lund comes flying over to me, and he's like, hi, Matt, I've heard loads about you, like, can't wait to play with you, apparently you're a great player, and overly nice kind of thing, do you know what I mean? And I was kind of like, I remember my brother saying to me, like, that was a bit weird. I was like, I know, yeah. And then from then, like, I was fine, like, the lads were great with me and made kind of friends for life, because I was there from the age of 10, I think it was 10, at just 10, turned 10, and, you know, lads like Matt Lund and, you know, Ben Marshall, who obviously went on to do really well, and a few others, but yeah, it was just different at crew when I went there. It was just like, it was all about football, and they didn't take any, like, they wouldn't allow people to bully anyone. And it was just a breath of fresh air, to be honest with you. And that's kind of how it started at crew. And to be honest, it wasn't all sunshine and roses. When you come through at crew and you see people say, oh, you come through at the academy at crew and you must have done well and it must have been easy, but it was so difficult. Like, so in the academy, you get to 14 and then they decide again whether they're going to keep you on again. And at 14, I just was in my shell, like totally and utterly in my shell. I weren't, my mum used to say to me, you're not playing how you can play. And I was just said to her, like, I just can't, I'm so nervous, like, I can't perform. And God forbid, if Daddy-O walked over to watch training, I would just fall to pieces. And I mean, like, I wrecked, like, I couldn't kick a ball anymore. Just because Daddy-O was watching, who was like the messiah, like, Daddy-O was watching, oh my God, like, I've got to be the best player on the pitch now. And yeah, for a long time, I think Dario didn't think I was any good until I was 18. Genuinely, that is a fact. Jay Collins and Neil Critchley both had to fight. And they told me, they said, we don't want to make you feel like you've not earned this, but we had to fight for 2.5 hours for Dario to give you a scholarship. And I still speak to Jay and Neil now and Critch as well, because they're the ones who made me a player in the end, because I just felt really comfortable when they were the youth team managers. I just felt like I could play like how I wanted to play and play with confidence, because I knew that they thought I was a good player. But they used to say to me, they'd say, so basically when you're in the youth team, that on a Monday, Daddy would come in and he'd say to him, right, who played well in the youth team on Saturday? And he said, every week, you were the number one player. And I'd say to Daddy, oh, Matt Tootle was the best player. And he'd go, right, who else? And he just weren't bothered. He weren't interested. And that made it really difficult for me, because then this big thing with Daddy O being like so important at Crewe, and everyone, when you come through at Crewe, everyone wants Daddy O to like them. If Daddy O doesn't like you, then you've got no chance, basically. And I just kept plugging away, to be honest with you, Stuart. Yeah, I just kept going and kept fighting and was the best player probably both seasons in the youth team. And then obviously a good job being the manager then when I kind of got my pro contract. Again, I meant to say this earlier, but when if you asked anyone at Crewe, anyone I come through with, anyone who spent a lot of time with me at Crewe, they would tell you that I was one of the most determined lads and most professional and zoned in on what I wanted to do that they'd ever seen, because I was. I wanted to be a footballer more than anything. I didn't start drinking until I was 23. I never touched a drop of alcohol until my mental health started. I'd never bit oversharing, but I was a virgin till really late, because my uncle told me, stay away from women. He nearly made it, my uncle, as a footballer, and he said money, women and drugs, like, and alcohol, like, made him not make it. And he said to me, just do this for me, like, just stay away from women and stay away from drinking and all that crap, and you'll have a chance. Like, so I did, and I was so zoned in, and then I got this pro contract, and I was like, right, what can I do to stand out? And a few of the lads told me, like, in their first team, that good John Fadarson just loved lads who were fit, because he was Icelandic. And I know you probably, as true fans, probably look back and think, bloody hell, I forgot about good John Fadarson, mate. And
I'm not sure that's the case, Matt.
It wasn't a good time, was it, for you? Like, it was a weird situation. When good John come in, I remember even as an 18-year-old, I was like, how's he got the job? Like, and do you know what? What the maddest thing about it is, and I look back at it now, I think everything happens for a reason. And I don't think, if Daddy O was the manager at that time, that I would have got to the point where I was at, because I went away that summer. So obviously I got told I had a pro in, say, May, April, May, and then we have May and June off. Now, at that age, everyone would be going to Iron Apple or Ibiza or Marbella or, I don't know, wherever you go on these holidays when you're young. And my mum will tell you, but I said, I'm not going on holiday. My mates went on holiday. And for 2 months, I did 3 45-minute runs a day, every day for 2 months. Now, I can tell you that that's like, it's about 7.5K, 8K, like, times three in a day. So it's like 24K a day. And I mean every day. Like, I was so like, I'm going to be the fittest person anyone's ever seen. So I did that and I went back in. And then on my first day, pre-season, good John Fadarson says, we're doing a run around Rhys Heath, around the perimeter of Rhys Heath. And it was a 44-minute run. And I was thinking, this is going to be good for me. Now, I ended up, it was 16 laps at the perimeter of Rhys Heath. And I think everyone was doing it in kind of 45, 44 minutes. And I was doing it in 31. Now, at that point, it was good for me, but the lads hated me. Like, literally, the lads, like, at the time, it was like Danny O'Donnell, Anthony Eldin, Stephen Schumacher, even a few of the ones who were a little bit older than me hated me, like Luke Murphy, James Bailey. They were all on me, like, you need to stop this, you're killing us.
If I could just jump in there, Matt, is Anthony Eldin still going? Is he still doing laps?
Well, he was the one, because I lapped him, right? He was the closest to me, and he was doing it in about 39 minutes. But he really lost his rag with me, because I lapped him twice. So basically, I'd gone round and gone round again, and I lapped him. And the second time I went past him, he tried to trip me up, and he really lost his rag with me. And I was just like, what's happening here? And he was like, you're having us all off, basically. You'll get back in the dressing room and the lads are like, you need to stop like doing it, because you're killing us all. And I'm doing it for me. Like, in my head at that time, I wasn't there to make any friends. I wasn't there to be anyone's friend at football. I was there to be the best footballer I could and to have the best career possible at that time. And I was so zoned in on that, like, that I didn't care what anyone thought of me. I was like, this is going to work for me, so I'm going to do it. So I just kept doing it. And then in the end, Good John would single me out and be like, if he can do it, you can all do it, kind of thing. So, listen, if I'm going into a pre-season this summer and there's an 18-year-old lad doing that to me, I'm doing the same thing to him, by the way, because you'd lose your head. Honestly, it's a nightmare. But at that time, that was what I needed to do. And I feel like that got me my... I was the only first-year pro who got a squad number that year. So
Can I go to that then quickly, Matt? So I was going to ask, with Goodjohn, one of the things that is probably the reason why he got the sack other than the results was the fact that the youth team weren't getting a look in. You just said you were the only person that got a squad number that year. What was the feeling in the group? Because obviously you've already mentioned Ben Marshall, Matt Lund. They left. Yeah. They went somewhere else.
Well, I remember speaking to Ben and Matt at the time, and they both said, now Dario's gone, we're not going to get a chance. So this option's come available and we might as well go and play at a higher level at the time as well. So that was the feeling, yeah. The feeling was that it's going to be a lot harder to kind of get in the first team now than it would have been while Dario was the manager. And I think Goodjohn put me in there just because he felt I'd earned it, not because he thought I was a good player or anything like that, but he felt like I'd earned the fact to have that the squad number. And I can't really remember how many games he was managing my first season. It was 2009-2010, but I think he was only about 6 or 7 games, wasn't he, or something like that in that season.
I think he went in November, so I think it was probably a bit longer than that. I think it was probably about 12.
Yeah. Because I made my debut on November the 21st.
Northampton, wasn't it?
Northampton away, yeah. And that came as a surprise anyway. But definitely when Dario stepped away and Goodjohn came in, it was a strange to walk through, isn't it, how it's ran. And I don't think Dario was the biggest fan of the whole idea, to be honest with you. So it was always never going to last in that situation. And then I came in one day and my agent rang me and said, oh, the manager's going to get sacked today and Dario's going to take over again. And I'll be honest, for me, I was upset at that time just because I knew what Dario thought of me and I knew that it was going to be difficult for me to perform to my ability while Dario was watching because he just had this thing. If Dario said well done to me, it would be like, I can't tell you the feeling I would get of Dario saying well done to me or something. I would just be like, oh my God, like that's amazing. Like Dario Gradi just said well done to me. And you know what? I've still to this day now, I haven't spoken to him for a long time. I'd love to speak to him again because now looking back at my time, I'm so glad that he was like the way he was with me because he turned me into a perfectionist. And sometimes that's been good for me. And other times as a footballer, that's been really, really bad. And I've got OCD now. And that's what the main part of my mental health was, OCD. So, I feel like that a lot of that was brought on by Dario expecting everyone to be kind of perfect and technically be so good. And one thing I know for sure is that what he did with me is I can play football. Do you know what I mean? I know technically I've got all the ability of someone who plays in the Premier League. Like that's a fact. Like anyone who's come through, you know, you look at Westy and me made our debuts on the same day. Now, Westy's technical ability is unbelievably brilliant, but there's a lot of things that he does that I could do as well. Do you know what I mean? But that's football. But I know what Dario does is he makes players be technically good. Then it's up to them. And it's down to the player in the end to be able to perform on a pitch and in their position and be the best at that position. But what he'll always do is create a footballer aesthetically as a top technical player. And I think I'll always thank him for that because that's held me instead. Every manager I've had has always said I'm a really good footballer. Whether they like me or not as a player, they'll say, yeah, you're a very good footballer. And I think that's definitely held me in good stead. And I always had this thing against Dario when I was younger that I wish he liked me more.
You were, having said all that about Dario, you were actually quite a mainstay in his team when he came back after Goodjohn. Yeah. He played most of the games. We've discussed this before on this podcast. When it was time for him to leave, I'm going to skip on a couple of seasons. There was quite a lot of negativity at the club. I don't know if you were playing in the home defeat to Torquay. I think that was his last game. I was there, I went with my brother, and I just remember it was incredibly sad for me as a fan who'd grown up watching Dario Gradi teams. You know, this man had built the club to what it was. But then there was like a realisation that it was time to go. I think half of the ground was booing him at the final whistle. I didn't agree with that personally. I didn't think, you know, I thought he'd earned the right to leave without being booed off. But what was the feeling in the squad in that season when, you know, it looked like it was time for Dario to step aside from first team managing?
Yeah, I agree with you there. I don't think he should have ever been booed. And you know what? I think, as I said, I've got like ultimate respect for him and what he done for Crew. He's made, at the end of the day, Crew, still to this day now, the way Crew runs is because of Dario, and that's a fact, you know what I mean? And And even the way that Dave still makes the team play, it's the way Dario's done it. And that's why Dave does it, because he knows that's what crew is. And that's why they make players like Charlie Kirk's and Callum Ainley's. And, you know, you still have them, the players who've got so much ability and talent. But at the time, I'll be really honest with you, at the time, we had players like myself who were struggling to perform to our full potential under him. Luke Murphy was really so talented, but Dario was after him. He was always after him and telling him off. And I could tell, overthinking stuff in his mind. And it got to a point where he's someone who's going to just let us play and not kind of have a go at us for mistakes and not try and kind of just let us go. Do you know what I mean? And I think when it did happen then, and when then Steve came in, Steve did a good job, but I think a lot of people could have come in and done what Steve done, because the squad was that good that it just needed freshening up. The training needed to be more, you know, with Dario, it was technical, and he didn't like having games and training and stuff. So we do a lot of technical stuff. And then usually at the end of training, you have a 20-minute game, like a bit of a fun game. Dario didn't agree with that, so we didn't do that. And it was literally, we just needed to turn the place into somewhere fun to come and make everyone smile and make everyone have a good time. And that's what Steve quite clearly could see that he needed to do. And straight away, that's what he'd done. And then you think, you know, 19 games unbeaten. It was just ready to take off, to be honest with you. And I think, you know, looking back at it now, it was all a blur to me. I was so young. I think I was 20, 21 or whatever. And it was just, I was just playing football and just enjoying it, which was great.
So when Steve Davis comes in, as you just said, he doesn't really do a lot. He just makes it a little bit more fun. Obviously, the aim within the squad can't have been to push on to playoffs and get in the playoff final, because I think we were 18th when Steve Davis came in. At what stage of the season did you realise, hang on, we're on to something good here?
You know what? What was weird was, I felt like what it was like was we were playing in the youth team, and we weren't playing to win. We were just playing to kind of play well. And that's how it felt, is we were all going out there thinking, like, if we all play well, then we'll win or we'll do well or whatever. It didn't really matter if we won. And then all of a sudden, there was about 5 or 6 games left. Obviously, we've gone 11, 10 games unbeaten, and we're like, one 10 games unbeaten here, but there's still 8 games left. And we didn't really speak about it until the Cheltenham game at home, was when Steve said, like, listen, we could actually do this kind of thing. And I think that was the second to last or the last game. It might have been the talky one as well. But we started to, like, actually speak about it. But I remember at the time, no one, like, the lads between themselves, but Steve never really mentioned anything about getting in the playoffs. And I mean, the last 2 or 3 games, we were like, we could actually do this here, like. And that's why it all worked so well, because we were just on the crest of a wave kind of thing, and it really did just all just fall into place kind of thing. So yeah, but there weren't a lot of when Steve come in, he didn't say let's go and get in the playoffs this season and get promoted, lads.
We weren't ever expecting anything. It was literally just Steve wanted to come in and enjoy playing football and kind of enjoy coming to work. And one thing found, been nearly 31 now, if I ever go into management and coaching, what I would say is the first thing you've got to do for any club is come in and make the place a good place to come to, where you're looking forward to come to work. And that's what Steve done, really. He just made it a lot more lighthearted and a lot more kind of enjoyable to come to training at that time.
So at the start of that season, Dario is obviously in charge. We've had a mixed season the year before. We've had some amazing results. Like, we won 7-0 against Barnet and 8-1 against Cheltenham. We've had some awful ones, like that 5-5 draw with Chesterfield away. So the talent's obviously there. We've mullered some teams, but there's kind of a suspicion that there's a bit of a soft underbelly, and that when things aren't going our way, we kind of fold a little bit. But nevertheless, you know, some kind of journeyman players like Blanchett and Pat Adder have moved on, and young players are coming through, and there's a real kind of buzz around the place. Pre-season goes brilliantly, and then we lose the first 4 games, which obviously puts a lot of pressure on. But the one I wanted to ask you about was Plymouth away. I think, I could be wrong here, but I think the whole time I've been a Crewe fan, it's the only time we've been bottom of the whole football league. It's 4 games in. I think Plymouth are second bottom. I remember me and my brother drove down there, and I wondered if you remembered that game. And we won 1-0, I think.
I was injured, and I remember being sat in the gym on the bike, and I was speaking to Dave Artell and a couple of the other lads, and they were like, and Dave was a manager before when he was a player, so Dave was talking like he does now, and he was saying, we need to chill out, we're not in a relegation battle yet, like we're fine, but we need to get going soon. And I was injured, obviously, and I said, but basically, like, I was I don't think I played the first
I think I played the first game of the season and I hadn't played the next three. And I was kind of feeling like, and listen, you do, as a player, you do do this and people think that you don't do it. But as a player, you sometimes sit there thinking, oh, they're losing without me and I'm going to get back in the team kind of thing. But it got to a point where I was kind of like, I don't want them to lose again. So I obviously didn't go down to Plymouth. But then I seen on Sky Sports that we'd won 1-0 and I was over the moon because I thought that's a great result kind of thing. But yeah, that was a big game. Weirdly, that season, that was a very important game. I think that was probably the lowest point for me at Crewe when we were bottom of the league, really. There, like, really, like, scurdy kind of situation, if you know what I mean. So, yeah, it's an important game. But I know what you mean about the soft underbelly thing. And what that is, when you come through at Crewe, there's no real... it's not important to defend. You know, this is what happened. So, when Dario was the manager, me and Dougie on a Friday used to always go on the same team, and not because we like loved each other or anything, but just because we wanted to like we wanted to defend. We didn't want to try and score and stuff in the five sides. We wanted to like block shots and et cetera, et cetera. And we used to have a competition like on the way in, like I'll make more blocks than you today. And we'd both be throwing ourselves in front of balls on a Friday, hitting us in the face and hitting us in the back and see who could get the biggest red mark on our legs. And Dario wouldn't think it was good. Dario would just say, stop jumping around. So then Steve comes in and obviously Bates is there as well. And me and Dougie are doing that and they're both like brilliant class. And you're getting confidence from doing a block kind of thing. You know what I mean? And it's like, that's what they needed to instill into the team, is that we need to be able to battle as well. And what I done the other day was, obviously with lockdown, I've nearly completed Netflix now. So I went onto YouTube to find the Southend game, the second leg. So I watched the whole game, like, honestly. I was a bit emotional, I'll be honest. I was a little bit emotional watching it, thinking, oh, my career's gone, like, and now I look back at them times and I didn't even know how good they were. Do you know what I mean? I definitely didn't celebrate them times like I should have. I didn't have a drink at the party when we went up. Do you know what I mean? Like, I went home. As soon as we got back to the ground, I went home. Like, and now looking back, I should have woke up in a ditch somewhere, really. Do you know what I mean?
We are jumping ahead a little bit there, Matt. But if anyone's interested, there is something on YouTube, as you've just mentioned, the Southend game. And this is a little bit earlier than I was going to bring this up. But if I can't remember who it is. I think it's someone called Derek. He's put on the last 20 minutes of the Radio Stoke commentary away at Southend. And then it's like a full hour afterwards of Radio Stoke. So you've got 20 minutes, so you've got Max scoring, then you've got them equalising and Graham McGarry going absolutely bonkers on commentary and Pete Morse trying to hold it together. And then after that, Lee Blakeman comes on the pitch and he interviews almost every single person. And you're the first person he interviews. And in that interview, you've just finished playing a football match. You're quite emotional. You're going to Wembley. And I think you say the word Wembley more than any other word in the interview. It's only about a minute long, but you say Wembley, Wembley, we're going to Wembley. It's really, really fascinating for anyone. I think I've listened to it about 3 or 4 times. From a personal perspective, I wasn't there. I wasn't in the country. I was living in China at that point. So I had to watch it. I think it was like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning there when it was on. I was at home on my own. No one cares about Crewe in China. So, you know, it was just me. And I just remember listening to this and it was just being amazing. And, you know, I've gone back to it a few times. I don't know if you're aware that that's out there, but it's definitely worth a listen.
Not heard that, but I'll have to listen to that. No, but...
I can't remember who it is. It might be Dave Ortell. It might be Steve Phillips. And one of them says, there's no way this team is going to lose at Wembley because of the run that you'd been on. And sticking with those, so you've mentioned Dave Ortell. He was already a manager when he was still playing. Steve Phillips is obviously a big character. Lee Bell, he came in for that Southend game. How big were these? You know, these were the older pros in that squad. How big were they at keeping the younger lads' feet on the ground, keeping that run going, would you say?
They were massive, yeah. Do you know what? What I'd say about all three of them is that none of them outstanding footballers, and that's not a dig at them, but what they did was they did what they knew what they were good at kind of thing, and they done it. Do you know what I mean? And that's why they all had good careers in the game. And me and Steve Phillips had a great relationship, to be honest with you. We hated each other, but we loved each other at the same time. And I remember Steve coming in after he'd just signed a 2.5-year deal. And I was the first person he come to, and he went, "Oi, Snozzle, I've just signed a new 2.5-year deal. You've got to put up with me for 2 more years. And I was gutted, you know. I said to him, "Mark, gutted. I don't want to see you ever again." Like, because he just used to say I had a big nose, when he had a big nose as well. But like at that age, I wasn't really great with taking banter, like, because I wasn't really that involved with the lads. And I didn't go on nights out and stuff. I didn't get involved with them that much because I didn't want to be involved with footballers. It sounds ridiculous, but I was so different that I never wanted to be a lad or a footballer who only went out with footballers. I wanted my group of mates at home, and that's what I did. And that was great for me because they would let me go out and not drink. So I'd still go out and stuff with my mates, but I wouldn't drink. But Steve, me and Steve, yeah, he was just on me all the time, on me. Put DP in my boxes at least three times a week. And it was just, yeah. At the time, I remember I said to my mum, I think the goalie's bullying me a bit, but he weren't bullying me at all. It was just banter. Like, I do it, and it was because he liked me. So like, I do it to the young lads now, wherever I am, when I'm playing. If there's a young lad who I think's a bit cheeky and he's a bit funny, I'll have a banter with him and stuff. And that's because I like him. It's not bullying, do you know what I mean? And that's the problem with football now, is you've got to be so careful how you kind of treat younger players. But some of the stuff, I'll go on to it in a bit, but bloody hell, honestly. But yeah, so Steve, all three of them were great. And I remember I watched an interview not long ago. Someone sent it to me, actually, of Dave Artell speaking about me. And Dave said he can go as far as he wants to go because that's how good I am. And it made me really upset. Like, and I still get upset now because I know I didn't achieve what I should have achieved in the game. I mean, I'm sitting here now. I've got a job. I'm 30 years of age. I'm still in great shape. I'm still fit. I'm still healthy. And I'm sitting here. And when I think about stuff like that, but I know that it wasn't meant to be. Do you know what I mean? Like, I know that I wouldn't have been able to deal with the money. The money would have been, I would have been in a lot more debt. I would have been, the gambling would have been a lot more. And I probably wouldn't have come out of it with anything. But I know my ability. I've definitely not achieved what I should have. And it does upset me. But yeah, they were all great. They were all great. And I think Lee Bell that season come in, and he didn't play as much as he'd like because he had Luke Murphy and Ashley Westwood ahead of him. Obviously, you're not going to get much game time, but around the place and stuff, one thing you need, and I think what you found last year was very similar to the year we went up. And I said that at the start of the season, because you had people like Paul Green, Nicky Hunter. I'm with Paul Green now at Boston, and I was with Nicky Hunter at Crewe, and they're both at Notts County, and they're both absolutely great, like really good lads to have around the place. And you know, you had Eddie Nolan. And you had these old heads in the camp, but then you had the young lads who were full of ability. And I think one thing that you need in League Two, in League One, is you need that experience to go along with your young talent as well. And I think that's what worked last year as well. And there's so many similarities between the two teams. When I think about like the two teams that went up, like you've got promoted to League One. But I definitely think what's happened this year, obviously you've lost Perry and you've lost Pickering. Now, what's Pickering's first
Harry.
Name? I was going to say Ronnie then. Ronnie Pickering.
Not that one, no.
Yeah, Harry, yeah. No, yeah, Harry and Perry have obviously gone. Harry's still there, isn't he? But you have kept hold of players. You kept hold of Charlie, and I really didn't think you'd keep hold of Charlie. I thought he would end up getting a move. But the season we went up to League One, we lost Westie, and we lost Murph halfway through the year, didn't we? And I think our first season was similar to your first the season that I have now, which was a good first season.
Yeah.
And I think you'll do all right. I think it won't end up. Probably, I'd love them to get back to the championship. But I think it'll tail off because it's gonna be difficult now, really. But yeah, there's so many similarities between the two teams that got promoted that it shows you what you need to get promoted from League Two is you need talent, but you need them old heads too.
Yeah.
The main difference for this team is probably that we haven't got the Johnson Paints Trophy as a distraction that you had in that first season after you got promoted.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah. And you know what? I'll tell you what. With that is. Steve said to us that season, he said, I want us to concentrate more on the JPT. I want us to win it. And that was a shock to us. But I think Steve obviously wanted to win something. And I think he knew that because we'd got so many lads in on loan and stuff. And it was a bit of a mess that season, the first season. We had so many lads playing who weren't through players. You know what I mean? It was strange. Like we had obviously Chucks and we had Brad and we've got a few other lads in on loan. And it wasn't really a crew team. If I look back at it now, I think that was probably the least crew team I've seen for a while.
Even Pogba and Osman, who were our players, Osman, they weren't like typical Crewe Academy.
Abdul, great lad as well, and Pogs, what a lad Pogs is. Honestly, pair of them together, funny as anything. But no disrespect to them at all, but Dario would never have played them. That's what I mean by a Crewe player, is Dario would never have played Abdul Osman in the team. But as a fan and as a player as well, you know what Abdul offers to the team. He's a breaker-upper. And you need that sometimes, you know what I mean? And it worked for us, you know, for a while it worked. And then we had Anthony Grant as well, the year later. Another stopper kind of breaks it up and then passes it to the players who go and do the attack and stuff. But definitely it was a strange season all around that one, because I actually wasn't in the team. I was having a terrible run of form at that point. And Steve was making a decision whether who was going to play in the final. Because he brought in a lad from Liverpool. Forget his name though.
Can't remember that
and he played left back a few games ahead of me, which I remember Bates pulling me and saying, listen, you're still going to play, but you know, we want someone to challenge you because I feel like that's what you need. You need someone behind you. And anyway, I wouldn't want to watch that particular final because I was so nervous before that game. I didn't feel the nerves in the playoff final. I was playing left wing for whatever reason. And I just kind of went out and tried my best, to be honest with you. Like when I watched it back, it was just, the commentator kept saying, like, right place, wrong man all the time. Like, or once he was like, oh, when it comes to Tuta Lurd, he was never going to score. And I was just like, I've played well, to be fair. I've done really well considering I don't really play on the wing. And
it was the best throwing in the club's history.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that throwing between me and Kelvin, I'll tell you what, that doesn't get enough credit, I'll be honest with you. Every time it comes up on my Twitter feed, I just retweet it and say, what unbelievable play that was. Because it was beautiful manoeuvre to get it to Pauly. Like, Pauly did the easy bit. We just had to try and get in the space, you know what I mean? Unbelievable.
I was going to say, we sort of skipped onto the JPT. We've definitely missed out on the playoff final. I imagine that was quite a big moment in your playing career, first appearance at Wembley. We've also missed out your best mate scoring the first goal at home to Southend in the playoff semi-final. I'm sure he wouldn't forgive you for not mentioning that.
Yeah, no. Do you know what I meant to say earlier? But when we were on this run and we were going for the playoffs, like I must have been 20, 21 and Dougie was like 25, 26. And I always used to think Dougie was a lot older than me. And he was like really old. And obviously driving in with him every day and driving in. And Dougie said to me, he said, I think we were like 10 games before the end of the season. Dougie said, Toots, you know, we're on the cusp of greatness. I'll never forget it. But he said, we're on the cusp of greatness. And I was like, what do you mean? He was like, we're this close to like achieving something really, really amazing. Like we're really close to it. Like, and we did in the end. And I remember driving into the actual Southend game with Dougie. And Dougie was saying to me, like, this is the biggest game I've ever played in, like ever. And Dougie would be a great one to get on because where Dougie came from and how he ended up getting back in at Crewe was remarkable, to be honest with you. Honestly, remarkable. Like he came to Crewe and he rang up Daddy Og to come to Crewe and basically said, I just want to get fit. Is it all right if I come training with you? And it's quite clever what he'd done because he knew if he could get in the door that he'd get a deal because he was so fit and he was so determined. And Dougie was a good centre-half on his day, very good centre-half on his day. He's a bit stiff, which he'd laugh if I said it because we used to go out every day before training to do a little bit of work to try and make him not so tin man because he couldn't move, honestly. Once he got going, he used to call himself the Volvo. He said, I'm like a Volvo. He said, once I get going, I'm the fastest player at the club. He said, but it's getting going, that's the problem. But it was great for him to score the header. Like when I seen it again the other day when I watched the game, I was like, that must have been so amazing for him as an individual, for where he'd come from to then come back and then be playing and kind of score that header to kind of give us the win was amazing for him. Yeah, so I was made up for him, but I didn't hear the end of it for ages. He still thinks that he got us promoted that year. So
nothing to do with Nick Powell or, you know, anyone else that
nothing to do with Nick at all. No. It was no one's doing apart from Dougie's, that's it. But no, that was great, yeah, because do you know what's mad about football? And if you've never played football this year, you spend a lot of time with people, and I spent 6-5 years with Doug. And now, like, I haven't seen Dougie for 3 years, like face-to-face, 3 years or something like that. And still speak to him occasionally and here and there. And he's an agent now. He's top agent, to be fair to him, yeah. So, but you just lose touch with people. And I was so close to Doug. And Doug was, like, my mentor. Like, he taught me so many things that I live and breathe by now, like little sayings that he used to say. But he was good for me, really good for me. And I will always be, like, grateful to have that. The time that I spent with him and the things we've done together.
Do you have more fun on nights out, which were kind of like, you know, club nights out or sort of like away sort of weekends? Or did you have more fun with like closed season and you went out in Liverpool or?
Christmas do's were unbelievable, yeah. Dougie used to take me out in Liverpool, but Dougie was I didn't like going out with Doug when it was in Liverpool because he knew everyone and I was just his little sidekick, you know what I mean? And like, no one knew who I was. And then we tried to get into there's a bar in Liverpool, I can't remember what it's called now. I think it's been closed down, but we couldn't get in. But Dougie got in and I told him to go in and I went home because I was like, I don't want to wreck his night kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? Because I felt like I was just there because he wanted me there, but I felt like I would wreck his night. Do you know what I mean? So it was like, but Christmas do's were brilliant. That's what I was going to tell you earlier. Do you remember Scott Shearer?
Yeah.
Yeah, the keeper.
Oh, what a bloke he was, honestly. So these goalies, I've got Steve Phillips, who's a bit of a loon, to be fair, Steve. Good lad, but he's a bit mad as well. And then Scott Shearer was just absolute, oh, what a legend he was, mate, honestly. And we went on the Christmas do and stuff, and he was just carnage. Like, some of the stuff he was up to, I just couldn't believe it. So that kind of opened my eyes, because the first few Christmas do's, and I remember we went to Chester one year, and Stephen Schumacher was there, and Danny O'Donnell, and they all had the kitty. It was about 2.5 grand in this kitty. Anyway, because I was a young lad and I don't really drink much, So we had the weekend. So it was a Saturday night and a Sunday. And on the Saturday morning, the game got cancelled. For I can't remember why it got cancelled, but basically all the lads were like, we're going to Chester at 12:30. And I was like, I remember I was quite close with Danny Shelley. Me and Shell were, Shell's like, we're kind of like not really in the in crowd. Like we were like, just kept ourselves to ourselves. And he rang me. He was like, I'm not going at 12. I was like, nah, me neither. I'm going at about 6:30. Like I'm not going all day. I'll be steaming. So he turns up and there's no kitty money left, right? So the kitty money's meant to go on a table, like at a club and all day for the Sunday. And Stephen Schumacher and Danny O'Donnell and all them and Matt Mitchell, they've put it on a horse, right? And apparently it lost by a nose, but they've put it on a horse, like straight up as well, not even each way, to win this race, to try and get like 10 grand or something like that. And it lost. So there's no kitty money left. I'm skint anyway, because I'm only on about 100 quid a week, like first year pro. And me and like a few of the other lads absolutely fuming. We're like, you know what? Like, I can't believe they've done that. Like, that's our money kind of thing. And looking back at it now, it's actually really bad what they've done, because the kitty money is like fines and whatever, and everyone's committed to that. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I've probably put £200 into that throughout the year, throughout the 6 months or whatever. And they've gone and put it on a horse. But that was, it's just ridiculous, that, isn't it? But it's, looking back, it's quite funny, but it's like, it's mad, yeah.
Yeah, I don't but imagine it was very funny at the time.
No, I was fuming because I've turned up, mate. I'll be honest. Like, I was 18, 19. I took 200 quid with me thinking, will this last me for the full weekend? Like, I'm brassic. But then I was thinking, oh, but at least I'll get most of my drinks out the kitty. And then it's gone. And I'm like, I haven't got enough money here to last me kind of thing. And then we were at the end of the meal. We had a meal before we went out at Pizza Express. Proper glitz and glam, like proper footballers night out, like. And all the lads were drinking and like having bottles of wine and all this. And then they tried to split the bill straight down the middle, like everyone had to pay the same. And all like the first year pros were like, I'm not paying that. I only had a pizza and a Coke or a pint or whatever. And they're trying to make me pay 50 quid. And I'm like, I'm paying what I've had. Ridiculous. So then we ended up all splitting off that night. Like it was, but that was like my first experience for Christmas too. Like, but then when we, but yeah, again, that's still quite early on. And then, so then we've got, obviously, back to the playoff final. Something I wanted to say there is that I didn't get to enjoy the playoff final at all because I got drug tested straight away after the whistle goes. And the whistle goes and this guy comes over to me and he's like, oh, you've been picked to do a drug test. I was like, all right, well, can I go and lift the trophy, like? And he's like, yeah, you can go and, you know, do everything you need to do now, but I need to keep my head. You've got to come in and do a drug test. I was like, yeah, no problem. So, you know, we've gone up and we've lifted the trophy and then we've gone around the fans or whatever and all that. And then I've been dragged into this room. And I don't know about you lads, but I can't do it in front of people. Like, I really can't do it. I can't wait in front of people at all. And I'll tell you later on, I've got a new technique now, but it pulled me in and I can't, I haven't weed for 3.5 hours. So the bus didn't leave Wembley until, I can't remember what time kickoff was that day. Was it 2 o'clock or was it four? I won't remember, but the game finished and then 3.5 hours after it, I finally weed, right? And I'm thinking, right, I can go and enjoy myself now. I've gone into this dressing room. It's about this deep. The dressing room's this deep in like beer on the floor. There's no one in there. It's just a mess. There's one bottle of beer left in a big crate and I've missed it all. Do you know what I mean? I've missed the whole getting back into the dressing room and going wild and all the lads jumping on each other. And
I think we heard exactly the same story from Sean Smith from the 97 playoff final when he said he had to go and then he came in and just sat and had a beer with Fleety and that was it. Everyone had gone.
Oh, Fleety. Why haven't we spoke about Fleety? That bloke, mate, honestly. What a guy, yeah. Fleety weren't the kit man then. It was Mark Cunningham, I think. But I walked in and Mark was like, oh, it's everyone's on the bus waiting for you. I was like, all right, great. So I got a shower as quick as I could and then got on the bus. And there was no beer on the bus either. So then we got like a 3.5 hour drive back to the ground where it was a bit of a party, whatever. But then I was past the point then. Like, I just wanted to go home. And I was knackered and it was a hot day, wasn't it? And I think because I hadn't drank much that day, if I'd have had a few bevvies, I probably would have wanted to stay. But I ended up just going home about an hour and a half after we got back to the stadium and didn't really ever sink in. I think, you know what, it sunk in more last week when I watched it, how big a day that was for me. Like that, you know, I always walk around and say that I've won at Wembley twice, mate. You can't talk to me kind of thing. And I know how big of a deal it is. And I've got my medals and it's great. And I love that I've achieved that with Crewe because Crewe was always my team kind of thing. So, you know, if I was going to have success at any club, I'm glad that it was with Crewe, like more than any, because I think throughout my career, I look back at Crewe and that's where I'm most kind of loved been, you know what I mean?
Have you still got your medals,
Matt? Yeah, I have. But so I don't know if you what my brother does, but my brother owns Toots Boots UK, a football boot customization company, the biggest ever in the UK. There's many others trying to replicate what he's doing, but he's the best. But he's got a an office now, and he's got it on the wall in there because he's got a bit of a shrine going on. So yeah, so it's back there at the moment, but they're framed and stuff. So yeah, it's great. But no, that them kind of things, that's why you want to be a footballer, if you know what I mean. At the end of the year, at the end of your career, if you've not got a medal or you've not got anything to kind of look back at and go, oh, look what I achieved. You know, at this point now, I've got them two medals, and then I've got 5 Player of the Season awards, a Young Player of the Season awards. I've got I got a Notts County, a Most Embarrassing Moment award for my celebration.
Oh, the slug.
Do you remember the slug? Yeah, yeah. The chairman gave me a Most Embarrassing Moment award, and I've got that as well somewhere. But
that's not on the wall then, no?
No, that's not a wall. No, it's shoved away somewhere where no one can see that one. But
so we'll have to update your Wikipedia page for that one, I think.
Yeah, it plays a purpose. That was another good time, yeah. But so yeah, the first Wembley wasn't as good as the second one, I would say. I enjoyed the second one a little bit more afterwards because I got to enjoy the kind of celebration part of it. But
I think you're probably the only person along with me then, because if people that have listened before, it's the only one I've actually managed to make it to. I was back in the UK and I was at the JPT final. I missed 97. I missed the playoffs the year before. So it's just you and me that enjoyed that one more than ever. Because I remember speaking to my friends, I was like, we've won at Wembley. And they're like, yeah, no, we did it last year as well. You know, it's easy.
Yeah, it was getting boring, wasn't it? Got to go to Wembley again. Bloody hell. Yeah. No, there's players who've played in the Premier League for 12, 15 years who never got to play at Wembley. So to be able to go there twice with crew and win as well, most importantly, because I can imagine going there and losing isn't very good. So to go there and keep 2 clean sheets and win twice was just amazing, really. So to look back at that and go, that's something really, really amazing to have done. Definitely, yeah.
If we can move away from playing football for a minute or two, there's 2 things I want to talk about your time at Crewe still. They're both off the field. The first one we sort of alluded to with the intro, the Dugdale and Tootle show. How does that come about?
Do you know what? I don't really remember how it started. I remember we were messing about after training and the kind of media guy, I forget his name, he'll be fuming, I forgot, Rob. I think it was Rob at the time, yeah. Rob was saying, oh, we need to do something different. We need to try and get something started. And why don't you 2 do something? And then we had a little mess about with it and a play or whatever. And then it just snowballed, to be honest. Yeah. It just ended up being something that everyone wanted to see. And do you know what? When I think about it, we were so ahead of our time with that. Like, there was none of that happening at other clubs, was there, at that time?
There was nothing like that at Crewe at all,
came along. Yeah, yeah. And it went down really well. And I think I kind of got to show who I was, which I liked. And my mum always said to me, if I wasn't going to be a footballer, I was going to end up on the stage or something, or on the telly with some kind of show or whatever, because I love being in front of a camera. Me, I always have done. If a camera come into Crewe, I'd want to be the centre of it. I would want, whatever we were doing, I would want to be the one who was doing it. You know what I mean? So it kind of suited me. And it was just a laugh. Like, just that kind of summed it up, really, when Steve came in and we were just having a laugh. Do you know what I mean? We were enjoying ourselves. And when you're enjoying yourself off the pitch, you're going to be enjoying yourself on the pitch, because it's just, if you feel good away from football, then you're going to feel good during football. And that's just kind of summed it all up. And that's why it went well. And I think it was great, yeah. And it was just a laugh all the time.
And then to change the topics, quite a bit, you know, you obviously missed quite a lot of what turned out to be your last season with the club. It wasn't really revealed at the time to the fans, but it was revealed later that you were suffering from depression. I think the first thing for me to ask is, how are you doing with that today? Like, how's things going with that now?
Yeah, now I'm totally fine. Like, I have my days, and I'd even say I have my weeks. But when you go through something, and I think, you know, I don't need to know whether you've been through anything. It's not important to me, but not just not important to me, but it's you don't have to tell me anything you don't want to tell me. But when you go through something, it changes your whole perspective on everything, and you learn that you can't let your brain you can't build stuff up in your brain. You have to keep on top of your brain, and your brain is the most important part of your body, and you have to always be on top of it. And what I've learned to do now is just be really, really, you know, observant of what's going on in my mind, and make sure that I keep on top of that. And I've been fine for 2.5 years, 3 years. I've not had any kind of trouble at all, like with mental health or anything like that.
But for me, this podcast excited me more than anything because I feel like I left Crewe under a cloud. And I think what people don't understand at all is one of the hardest things for me ever was when I left Crewe, after fighting to stay at Crewe, by the way, the abuse that I got and the messages I received, and I couldn't kind of say anything back. And I wanted to tell people, like, listen, like, I've not been trying to force anything through. I've not been trying to force a move. Like, I want to play football for Crewe kind of thing. And I did. And when Perry got his move the other day, I read the comments of when he left the club and he got this heroes leaving and this kind of, you know, everyone congratulating him and everyone saying, like, good luck. And it wasn't that I was jealous or anything like that. It was just, it hurts me so much that when I left Crewe, I didn't really get anyone say anything nice to me. It was just that I was whatever, you know, the words that I got called. And at that time in my life, I was in such a bad place that it really, really, like, really pushed me to a bad place, because all I wanted ever was to do well for Crewe and to fight for Crewe and to be the best player I could be. And kind of be, as a footballer, I've always wanted to be the player on the pitch that the fans look at and go, do you know what? If I was a player, I'd play like Toots, because he works his nuts off and doesn't give up.
Do you think you were possibly a couple of years ahead with depression? Because it's something that just wasn't talked about, especially with men, until about 3, 4, 5 years ago. You know, I've got a bit of experience, like you said, with like recognizing triggers and things like that nowadays. I think it's so much more open now when people say, you know, I'm struggling a little bit, I'm not feeling my best today. If what you were going through happened 3, 4 years later, it would be known and you could sort of, I don't know. Did you think you had to hide it?
If I'm honest, like, and I'm not taking credit for this at all, and I don't think I get enough credit, but I think I started a lot of what's gone on in the last 4 to 5 years. Because I was one of the first people to kind of open up about it. And I opened up about it well too early. But I thought I was all right, but I wasn't at all in the place to kind of speak out about it like I did. I don't think it would have made it any easier for me if it happened now, say, because the mental health that I went through. So I've got a OCD and an irrational thoughts disorder. You don't know what that is. It basically means you make stuff up in your head that you've done wrong, and it makes you feel worthless. And so what was happening was that the start of the season. So obviously I had the season where I got player of the season when we stayed up, and it was probably my best season in a Crewe shirt. And I think you should all admit that as well. Like, I was just zoned into this. I was the main man at that time. I felt like Murph had gone, Westy had gone, and I felt like it was my time to kind of go, right, I want to step up to this. And everything that happened in the summer before that season as well, on the pre-season trip, and everyone around the place was really down and in a bad way. And I was kind of like, I'm not going to let this affect how I play. I'm just going to keep trying to be the best player. And I think I just, that season anyway, I just played well every single game I played. I didn't play a bad game that year. And at that time, I'll be honest, and I'll say this to you all now, is that at that time I thought, you know, I've got an agent obviously at the time, and he's saying to me, listen, keep going. And then it gets January and he's telling me clubs are going to bid for me and et cetera. And I'm kind of like, I don't care. Like, I just want to play well and that'll all come. Now, as a player, like you've just seen with Perry and Harry and moves, and when Westy and Murmur moves, like, you come through at Crewe, but you know that if you do well, you're going to get your move. Money motivated me massively, because I've come from nothing. Like, my family have never had money, and I wanted to kind of be successful as a footballer, not just because I love football and I wanted to be a good footballer, but because I wanted to give something back to my family. I wanted to make them secure and be able to say to them, you can have that. I'll do that for you. I'll do this for you. Because my biggest problem as a person is I'm too generous and I love giving stuff away. I'll give my last penny to anyone because that's just how I am. But I did want to go and play higher, but that isn't me being disloyal to Crewe or anything like that. That's just me having ambitions to go, I want to show how good I am at a higher level, but I also want the rewards that come with that. So come to January come and went, and I didn't get a move. That's fine. I obviously finished the season. I got played a season. Great. My agent's like, listen, you've still got a year on your deal, but I'd imagine you're going to get a move. Dario comes out and does this interview about me being the next £1 million player at Crewe. And I'm kind of on cloud nine thinking, Dario's even saying it about me. I must be good kind of thing. Went on holiday. And then bang, it just triggered one day. You won't believe how
quickly it triggered, but my mental health on that holiday, I just wanted to get home. I kept going back to the room while I was with the girl I was with at the time and just getting in bed in the middle of the day and just crying and just felt trapped. I felt like I needed to get home as fast as I could. I didn't want to be out of the country any longer because I felt like I was wanted. It was weird, the weirdest feeling ever. And that just snowballed. And then I didn't tell anyone, obviously, for the first 16 games it was, I think. And I was trying to play. I was trying to keep playing. But every time I was walking out onto the pitch, I had this thing in my mind that was telling me if people knew what you were really like, they wouldn't be supporting you. These fans who were in the crowd wouldn't like you if they knew the truth about you. And this little demon in my head, when we played Sheffield United at home in the end, and the winger they had at the time, Jamie Murphy, he told me a new one. And I look back at it now, and I remember when, remember Joe Thompson?
Yeah.
The lad who had cancer?
Yeah. Again, at Rochdale.
His last game for Tranmere, or Rochdale, I think it was Tranmere or Rochdale, was against Crewe, and it was against me. And I had a great game, and I was thinking to myself, he's terrible. Like, and at the time, everyone was talking about him getting a move and being a good player. And he actually said in a podcast that day, like, the lad who played left back, he didn't say my name, but he was like, he just had me on talk because I couldn't play. Like, I was dizzy, I felt sick. And that's what happened to me at home against Sheffield United. I knew that everyone was expecting me to kind of still be this player that I was last season and go on to the next level if I'm going to. But I just couldn't perform. I just could not perform. And it got to a point. And on the Monday after that, then I just went in and I told the physio, I said that I need to go home. There's something going on in my mind and I don't know what it is, but I just can't be here. I need some time to kind of work out what's going on. Yeah, and that was it. And straight away for the next 3 months, when I kind of stayed away from football and went to the Priory and was getting treatment and stuff, the speculation starts to begin. And that was so hard, like hard to be sitting there and getting people say that I'm not playing because I'm trying to force a move in January. And then I do, in the end, finally think, right, I'm ready to get back in. So I come back in, I start getting fit again, and then I fall off a box in the gym and break my ankle. And then straight away then again, I'm out. And the fans are then saying, it's January time, the fans are saying, oh, he's trying to force a move. And then I'm at the end of my tether and I've kind of nibbled on Twitter and I've sent a picture of my ankle all black and blue and said, well, I'm injured, so I'm not forced to move, kind of thing. And I'll be honest, at that time, I was glad I got injured because I didn't feel ready to go back and play. I just didn't feel in the right mental state at all to go and perform again. And then it just kept going. The injury just was a really, really bad one. And I just didn't ever get fit again. And then I remember the lap of honour when we stayed up. I was crying. I was crying my eyes out the whole way around because I knew that I was going to be probably leaving. But I didn't know if I was ever going to be able to play football again. And I was totally and utterly in a place of just, I didn't know what was going to happen, and it was tough, really tough.
I think you're spot on with what you were saying there about people just didn't know how to deal with it. I would hope a young player in the same position today would be treated better at Crewe or anywhere, and you know, that's what I would hope would happen. Can I skip on a bit then? You spent a year at Shrewsbury. I think I'm not in the minority when, as a Crewe fan, we sort of keep our eyes out on ex-Crewe players and see how they get on at the other clubs, especially players like yourself who come through the academy. We sort of see you as one of our own. It was quite clear for me, because I've been following you on Twitter for a few years now, that you were quite well-liked at Notts County. You were quite well-respected. You seemed to be enjoying yourself. And then can I come to another incident in your life when, I think it was 2017, when you sort of announced that you had a gambling addiction? Do you mind sort of talking us through what happened there?
Yeah, so we'll have to skip back. So at Shrewsbury, I'll be quick, but at Shrewsbury, I went there under the cloud, and then I had Mickey Mellon, who was very old school and kind of didn't understand what was happening, because I spoke to him in the end after 16 games again that season, strangely. I said, I can't play, like, blah, blah, blah. And at that time, I'm going through all this, and then I had a baby with my partner at the time. Yeah, so she had the baby. And then when the baby was born, I found out it wasn't mine. Now, this is all obviously going on, and I've got this as well. And I'm just like, I'm literally just like, what is happening with my life here? Like, it's just absolute carnage. So then I start gambling, and I got paid up. And so I got to the summer at Shrewsbury, and they were kind of swaying towards the, you know, I knew I wasn't going to be staying, but they were like kind of saying, oh, we're going to pay you up. But I was saying, I'm not leaving unless I've got a club. Now, Richie Wellens had come in at Shrewsbury and basically
he didn't know what had happened, but he kept saying to me, why don't you play? Like, you're the best player in training, but you don't play on a Saturday. And I was like, I don't know, the manager don't like me. And then he said to me that John Sheridan was getting a job at Notts County. So I ended up going to Notts County. And then when I moved to Nottingham, they didn't put me up. They just paid for me to live in a hotel. But the hotel was opposite to a casino. Now, when I first come to Notts, like, I didn't, obviously, you don't know the lads straight away. And you're not, you don't have any mates there. And I'm in Nottingham on my own. And it's opposite a casino. And I'm trying to get over, you know, kind of in a weird way, I'm kind of bereaving a baby. And I'm also going through mental health still at that point. So it started in about 2015. That's when it got heavy. Anyway, I used to like a bet. When we was allowed to bet on football, because when I first started playing football, we were allowed to bet on anything that wasn't your league or any cup you've played in, you can't bet on it. So I used to like an accumulator on the Premier League or whatever. And it was in control. Like, I just liked 20 quid on a Saturday and whatever. And then when all this happened, I was just kind of in my own head. And the only thing I could do that took my mind off it and it made me think about money and numbers, like, was gambling. And it served its purpose. Like, genuinely, like, I would never want to gamble again. I don't ever think about gambling now. And I always said that I don't think I was addicted. I think I was literally just, I was in a place where I needed someone to keep my mind off everything that was going on in my life. But then obviously I've got paid up. So I've got a lump sum of money from Shrewsbury. And then I'm obviously signed for Notts County. So I'm still getting paid. And I've got this money and it just went. And then it turned into a bit of a snowball kind of situation where I was taking loans out to gamble and I kind of hid it away for a while and just kept going. And yeah, but so the first year at Notts was a bit like carnage with gambling and stuff and all that. And then kind of Kevin Nolan come into the club and Kev was like, if I could have had Kevin Nolan as my manager for my whole career, I would be playing in the Premier League. 1,000,000% I would, because he just understood me. Like, I remember his first week, like, he just knew like what I was, and he wanted me to be who I am as a person. He wanted me to be the person I am around the dressing room, around the club all the time. And basically that's a clown. Like, I am, like, I'm a clown at the end of the day, and that's what I should be. So, you know, week to week I was just acting a clown, making everyone laugh, being a tit, doing stupid stuff and messing about. And then on a Saturday when it's game time, I'll be one of the best players on the pitch because I know it's serious time. But he also knew that he could pull me in when he needed to and speak to me and ask me if I was okay. And he could tell if I wasn't okay. Do you know what I mean? And that's what I needed my whole career, is just someone who understood me. But it got to a point with the gambling where I needed to stop. Like, at some point I needed to stop because it was getting out of control. And I decided one day I was going to stop. And then a month later, I thought, do you know what? There's so many footballers I know for a fact, because every day I walk into the dressing room and all the lads do is talk about gambling and talk about what they won last night and what bet they put on. And I kind of thought, do you know what? I need to speak about this. I need to speak out about the gambling, like, because it can help people. Do you know what I mean? And the same thing with the mental health, is that I wanted to speak out about that kind of stuff, is because I didn't want people to go through what I was going through, because I knew once I started speaking to people about it and once I started being honest about it and telling people about it, I felt better. And I thought, you know what? It's obvious that speaking about your mental health and being honest about it makes you feel better, because it's out of your head. It's not in your head. So that's what I did. And now I do regret it. I regret being so honest so early, because it's definitely been a hinder to me getting clubs now, and clubs thinking that I'm not reliable, et cetera, et cetera. In the summer, when I didn't have a club for the first time in my career, I didn't have a club or a contract, and there wasn't a lot of interest. You know, most clubs I rang, or my agent rang, were like, yeah, he's a good player, but is he all right? Is his head okay? And, you know, that kind of really wound me up. And then that got me to a point where I'm thinking, you know what, like, I should never have spoke out about it. But then I've got people messaging me on Twitter and people saying to my face that I saved their life. Like, I literally, me speaking out about mental health made them think that they could be okay too. And I think what a lot of people with my situation, or any footballer who speaks about mental health, is they think, whoa, like, someone who's got everything can have mental health. Like, it's not, so basically it's not about money, or it's not about being someone, or it's not about having stuff. It can happen to anyone, kind of thing. I remember going out on a night out in Widnes after I'd spoke out about my mental health, and a lad who I went to school with actually said, it's so nice to see that someone who's got everything can struggle. And I didn't know whether to take it as an insult or not, because I was like, what do you mean it's nice to see that I've got mental health kind of thing? But he obviously thought that everything I had and everything I was doing, that I could never be sad kind of thing. And I think that kind of sums up mental health here, is that it doesn't matter what, how much money you've got, how many cars or boats or whatever you've got, you can still suffer mentally. And I think I regret it speaking out about it publicly, just because I feel like it's affected my career a lot. And I think people seem to think I'm this kind of cannon who could go off the rails at any point. Or I think it's just made me look a little bit unpredictable, or like, you know, difficult to handle kind of thing. But Kev Nolan mainly would tell you that I'm the easiest player he's ever managed. Like, you just need to know how to manage me. And what he did at the time as well was bring in a psychiatrist into the club for all the players. And he said to me, like, because I still see Kev now, Kev still lives in Nottingham, he's one of my best friends. And he said to me not long ago that season that we got the psychiatrist in, he said, I'm telling you now, nearly every single player come in saying that they had a problem with something and they just needed someone to speak to it about. Mm-hmm. And that's what you don't see. And then obviously then after that, he leaves and Neil Ardley comes in, and the less we speak about Neil, the better.
Okay, well, to stop you from saying something that might get you in trouble then, sticking with gambling in football, there's it's everywhere. You know, it's everywhere in football. It's in your adverts, it's on the TV shirts, it's on TV all the time. Do you think there's too much? Should there be a sort of partial ban? Should there be a complete ban? What's your thoughts on gambling in football at the minute?
I personally think it should be treated like drugs. I think as a professional footballer, when you go into a scholarship or say a pro, because you're old enough to gamble, then is you should be told if you've got a gambling site under your name that you can get banned from football. Because I know that, you know, a lot of the stuff that, the money wise, like, I'm 30 years old and I'm, you know, I've got a couple of properties, and other than that, I've not got a lot. And I know that if I wasn't a footballer, I probably would have a lot more than I've got now, because as a young lad, you know, coming to the first team at Crewe and, you know, getting £700-800 a week at 19, 20, like, it's a lot of money. Even that's a lot of money. But you then think about the lads who are in the Premier League who are getting 30, 40 grand a week at 18. And it's like, you know, you're trying to fill a hole in the end, because these young lads are like, I've got 40 grand a week or whatever. And you've got all this time, so much time on your hands, like, that what are you going to do with it? You've got to find somewhere to kind of stimulate your mind. And a lot of lads play PlayStation or whatever, that's great, but gambling does give off some kind of endorphin that I think footballers are always searching for, that kind of feeling, especially when you're injured or you're not playing and you're not getting that feeling, that Saturday buzz. Gambling is another way to get that. And I would love to see it in football mainly banned, like drugs are. You know, you can't take a drug as a footballer, so why not protect footballers financially as well and say, you know, you cannot gamble. You can gamble all you want when you retire, but while you're a footballer, we don't want to be any part of it. But the biggest issue with it is there's some of the biggest sponsorships in the game, and clubs can't then say, oh, none of our players gamble, because they probably half want players to gamble, because that's, you know, saying to fans, and oh, he gambles, look at that, that's good, isn't it? Like, you should do what he does. And it is such a tough one, really, to go around, and it'll never get stopped. It'll never get stopped. But throughout my career, I would say 5 lads in every dressing room I've been, I've had a gambling problem, 1,000,000%, every single one.
I think it probably is, from my own perception, my own sort of thinking, I think it's the next thing that we'll sort of get cracked down on. But there's just too much money that comes in. You know, look at the shirt sponsors in the Premier League, in the Championship. They're all gambling sites, and they're all gambling sites that they're not UK-based, that there's no control from the UK government on, you know, 138.com, for example, that just nothing's going to get done. But I think it is sort of an unspoken massive problem in football at the moment.
It's too hard for them to take it away, because it's so big financially for the higher leagues that they can't say, oh, none of our players can gamble anymore. And then still, I think they could do it, but I don't know. Maybe they're worried about a backlash of it, but I don't think there'd be any backlash. I think it'd be good. I think it'd be good for everyone. I think fans would like it, but then I think betting companies wouldn't like it, because there'd be so much exposure on it that they would think it's going to give them a negative outlook on their business, and they might lose business themselves. So they wouldn't want it to happen as much as anyone.
I mean, the thing as well is with gambling addiction of all things, I mean, my limited understanding of it is comparing it to like a drink addiction or something like that, you know, you can't go out and just ruin your entire life in one day with a drink addiction in the same way that you can with a gambling addiction, because you can just gamble away everything you own in one day effectively that you couldn't really do with, you know, with drinking. I think that's one of the things that's a bit misunderstood about it.
I always said with gambling, and I've said it to people, that I would have rather have been an alcoholic because it was cheaper. Because with gambling, you can walk in, you know, I used to go in on a Wednesday morning. And so Wednesday's a day off usually. And I'd go into the bookies. This is after I was single at this point, and obviously my head was massively up my ass. Like, but I'd walk into the bookies, I'd wait for it to open, and I'd walk in, be one of the first in, and get coffee from the woman behind the till, and she knew my name. And I look back and I think, how embarrassing is that, that the woman in William Hill knew my name, like 10 hours straight, having a battle with this roulette machine. And I'd sometimes walk out of there, like, after being $2,500 down, and I'd won back $2,400, and I'd walk out £100 down, and I'd feel like I'd won. And it's like, I'm £100 down, but and then a day later, I might go in there and put 50 quid in and win 250. But because I wasn't in there for very long, I hadn't got enough out of it. So I couldn't leave. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, and I'd end up walking out of the, I don't know, whatever down. And you think, it's just, honestly, once it grabs hold of you, it is, it gets to a point where these £20 notes that you're putting into this machine, that they're not money. It's like, you just want to see a number on the screen so you can bet. And it's just, they've done something now with them, apparently, which is good, where you can't bet over £2 or something like that.
They've took the limit on the fixed odds betting terminals down from £100 to £2, haven't they, recently, which is a good step forward. The issue is now that every kid, every fan has got their own fixed odds betting terminal in their pocket with their mobile phone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so
it's a lot easier to access.
You can go online and do it like that. And one of the things I liked about the actual bookies, because obviously I've grew up in a different era, was I liked the banter in there, and I liked all the blokes, like, loved that I was a footballer and, you know, wanted to speak to me, and it felt like home. And at the time I was living on my own, and all my friends were at uni and stuff like that, and I kind of didn't have any mates kind of thing. In the day, on a Wednesday, I was off, and I'm like, what am I going to do all day today? Like, I'm off all day. Like, what am I going to do? And sitting there all day, having a few bets and having a laugh. And yeah, that was kind of got to the point where I wanted to stop, was when I looked at one guy who was in this William Hill in Widnes, and he was really old. And I was just like, do I want to be him when I'm older? Like, is this what I want to be? And I didn't. I didn't want to be that person. I don't want to be that guy who sits in a bookies all day while his missus is at home, thinking, where is he, kind of thing. And I've been a liar as well. Like, I turned into a terrible liar. Like, phone's ringing all day, and usually my mum, and I'd be like, oh yeah, and I'm just here now, and I'll be home at this time, and then I wouldn't get home till that time. And it was just terrible, really. It's just it was a difficult time, to say the least. But again, like, you go through them times, and it teaches you something. Do you know what I mean? It teaches you something. And but then you've got the issue then going in with the lads. And I remember we had a night out in Notts County where we went to a bar. It was like a team night out, but the manager was there and stuff. And we went to a bar where it was Cheltenham, and they got their own bookie in. Mark Crossley, the goalkeeper, knew a bookie, and bookie came and he was taking bets and stuff. And the gaffer pulled me and was like, listen, are you going to be all right coming? And I was like, of course I am. Like, I'm not going to, like, what's it called? Like, I'm not going to have, you know, a mental breakdown because I can't put a bet on and everyone else is, you know what I mean? Like, so then that's where I had to make a joke out of it, and I'm, you know, be sitting there and be going, oh, I'm desperate for a bet, lads. Whoa, give me a go, you know what I mean? And, like, have a laugh about it. And that's the same thing I've always done with my mental health. So I'm still on a little bit of medication now, which I've slowly brought down. But, you know, you think about it. I've just done an interview on Sky Sports News about mental health, and how, you know, I've tried to take my own life. And then I've got to walk into a dressing room full of lads the day after, 25 lads who, you know, on a day-to-day basis, take the piss out of me. And, like, literally, because I love that. I love getting the piss out of me. And I had to walk in, and then I sat them all down and I said, listen, nothing any of you can do on a day-to-day basis will affect my mental health. Like, my mental health is somewhat different to anything, but do not stop taking the piss out of me. Do not treat me any differently, because I couldn't handle the fact that they might tiptoe around me and anything like that. So then I just started to make a joke about it. You know, obviously every day I have to take my pills, and I'd be
I'd be taking my pills in the dressing room going, oh, poor. You want to see how happy I'm going to be after I take these pills now? Then I'd be bouncing around and I'd take the pills and then start running around. Oh, I'm all right now. And kind of, you know, just take the piss out of it. And a lot of people wouldn't like hearing that. People who've got mental health issues would say, you know, it's not, they're not happy pills. And I agree, they're not happy pills because they don't make you happy. But for me, they make my brain a little bit more leveled kind of thing. And that's what I need. Kind of, that's what I need. I'd rather be here than be down here or right up here. And that's kind of where it is. But that's the only way I could survive in a dressing room is by taking a piss off myself and allowing them to see that I was, you know, I was fine, and them having banter with me wasn't going to make me go home and cry kind of thing.
You said that, you know, in terms of recognising and dealing with mental health issues, football has come a long way, in part because of some of the things you've said. And but it seems like the industry has still got a way to go. You know, if the fact that you've come out and talked about some of your problems means that clubs are avoiding you when it comes to contract time, then obviously the sport's still got some way to go before we get where we need to be.
Yeah, I always look at it in the sense, you look at Danny Rose at the minute, he's a high profile one. He's come out about mental health, I don't know, 2 years ago or 18 months ago, and he's not to be seen again at the minute. And, you know, we don't know the ins and outs of it. We don't know what's happening with that. But it adds up in my head that people think he's a bit of a cannon now, and they don't want to deal with him kind of thing. It's a tough one. And the thing is, with what I've said, is it could be controversial, but there's no way of me ever proving that a club haven't signed me because of my mental health. But, you know, when that's the issue with it, is that that'll never be sorted. And that's why I wish now I'd never spoke out about it publicly. I think I'd always urge players to speak out about it, but, you know, keep it in-house. But once it starts spreading, the news starts spreading, and it becomes a problem for some people because they don't know how to deal with it and they don't want to deal with it. And the worst thing is, especially in my situation, is I'm sitting here now, like, at Boston, and the season's been stopped, and I've still got so much to offer to a team at a full-time level, and I probably won't get that offer right now because of politics, because it's like, oh, he didn't play last season because I was injured all season and out of favour at Notts County, like an alien.
And all of the baggage.
Yeah, and then people look at it and go, oh, was he really injured or is he just struggling again? So then I've dropped down a level to play every week, and, you know, I've tried to do that, and it's obviously out of my power that the season's got stopped. But yeah, again, you're never going to be able to stop a manager in his room, in his office with his assistant manager saying, I don't really want to sign him because he's had mental health issues and, you know, he could be tough to deal with. Do you know what I mean? You're never gonna stop that kind of happening.
So would you say it's like a fine line between speaking out for your own mental health, but not speaking out to ruin your own reputation?
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping to speak on a bigger platform. Not to downgrade the biggest podcast going, by the way, but on a bigger platform. Kind of say that if I was a player now, you know, I would urge any player to speak out about mental health, but don't speak out publicly about it. And that's mainly because I feel like the PFA haven't done enough to help me. And I'm on the PFA website now. My story's on the PFA website. And I have people DM me on Instagram, on Twitter, footballers, you know, once a month saying, I've just seen your story on the PFA website and I wanted to speak to you about gambling or mental health. And the PFA haven't rang me or spoke to me in 3.5 years. And I'm like, well, why are they using me as an example, but they don't want to see how I am? Do you know what I'm saying? They don't want to make sure I'm okay. Like, you know, in the space of 2.5 years, I've gone from being player of the season at Notts County to a part-time footballer. And because I'm now classed as not in the PFA, because I'm not a professional footballer anymore, I don't matter kind of thing. And the biggest issue is, and I hope it's all sorted when there's a takeover happening now at the top, but, you know, I've tried to offer so much stuff to the PFA, and just because I'm Matt Tootle and I'm right at the bottom of the league and I'm not important, then I don't matter kind of thing. And that's where it's going to start from, is from the PFA and from the FA, and then we'll see. But it's something in normal life as well that is never not going to be somewhat difficult to work around, I think, in any normal workplace.
So it sounds to me like, have you got plans for the future for when you do finish playing football, that you're going to sort of take on all of the things that you've learned and help people? Is that something you've got plan to do, or are you going to try and stay in football, coaching, managing? What is it that you want to do?
Well, right now, like, I started an Instagram account in during the first lockdown where I wanted to kind of speak up mental health every day, and it got to a point where I couldn't get a club, and I thought, I need to stop doing this. And while I still feel like I've got something to offer in football, I'm going to stop talking about that, and I'm going to kind of go under the radar with it, because I need to just stop preaching about mental health, because people don't seem to want to understand me and what I'm doing, kind of thing. And that's just a decision I've made. And at the moment, do you know what? I'm going through a real transitional period in my life where I need to start thinking about the future, but I also want to, I still feel like I've got 3 or 4 years left in me where I can achieve something in football, and I don't want to take my eye off football because I want to go out with a bang. I don't want to end my career on the last 3 years that I've had. You know, I'm hoping that with Boston, if I do stay at Boston, which I hope I do, that we can get promoted to the conference, and then, you know, hopefully then try and get into the Football League and try and stay at Boston for a few years and leave a legacy there. And that's my plan, like my longer term plan. I think maybe coaching is something that I'm going to get into. But again, it's like, I'd love to go into the psychology side, but I don't want to go and do all the long courses that you have to do to kind of prove that you know about mental health. So I'd like, if I had the opportunity to go to a club one day where, or work for the PFA, if they ever listen to me, and kind of do it off my own experience. Because I think what I found with counsellors and people who talk to you about mental health is a lot of them haven't even been through mental health. So I found it hard to kind of sit in front of a guy who was trying to help me and listen to him when he's not been through anything himself. And I'm like, so how do you know where I'm at right now? And, you know, maybe if I did go and do the course to be a counsellor, you know, I can sit in front of some, because all I ever wanted to hear from a counsellor, have you been where I am and I'm all right now? I just wanted to know that I was going to be all right, and that there was proof that I was going, that people have been through what I've been through, and then they come out and they're happy again, like I am now. And I think in my situation, I could sit in front of someone and say, listen, I've been where you are, and now I'm happy. And that's what a lot of people want to know when they're struggling, is there's light at the end of the tunnel, kind of thing. So I'd love to go into that again, but I don't know, to be honest with you. I'm still so, I didn't expect to be at this point. I thought at this point now I'd be sitting somewhere with 2 years left on my contract, then I could go, right, I need to start planning for my future now, and it would be a lot less rushed. Whereas at the moment, I'm with coronavirus as well, I'm just getting forced into trying to think of what I'm going to do, and I don't want to rush into something, because I need to be passionate about it, and I am passionate about mental health, I really am, but it's something that I need to, if I'm going to do it for the rest of my life or for the next 30 years, I need to really want to do it, kind of thing. That's my issue at the minute. But right now I'm a part-time courier driver while I'm playing football as well. So that's where it's come to, lads. Yeah. I had 3 months or 4 months where I was training the night time as part-time, train twice a week in the night, and obviously play on a Tuesday or a Saturday as well. But and it weren't a money thing, because the money's actually surprisingly really good for what you're doing, you know, training twice and playing, you're getting good money for it. But I was sat, obviously with the lockdown as well, I'm sat in the house all the time, and I'm thinking, this is the worst thing possible for me, like, to be sitting around and having too much time to think and kind of, so I just kind of started applying for any job possible that I knew that I could still do while it was lockdown, but also I didn't need any kind of qualifications for it, and I got the job quite quickly, and it's been a blessing in disguise, because, you know, you do 10 to 12K while you're out and doing it and that, and keeps you busy 4 to 5 hours a day, and you look forward to getting home and sitting on the bed on your sofa or getting in bed or whatever again. Whereas when you're sitting at home all day and then you go into training in the night, like, you know, you're just tired all the time. So yeah, it's been a bit of a, brought me down to earth. But
have you ever had a situation where you've been dropping off someone's Amazon package and they've gone, hang on a second,
yeah,
no, I need
yeah. About 5 times, like, yeah, it's been mad. The fella walking past me in a Notts County jacket, and he said, Toots, is that you? And I was like, all right, mate. And he's like, what are you doing? I was legging it over the road with a parcel in my hand. I was like, oh, I'm just delivering a parcel, mate. I'm gone. But yeah, that's it. And that's football, lads, honestly, mate. It can just go like that. And it's a horrible business to be involved in at times, because you're never safe. You're never really safe. Like, and you can take your foot off the pedal for 1 minute, a bad luck with injuries, and a manager not liking you, and all of a sudden you're forgotten about, because, you know, you're out of sight, you're out of mind at the end of the day. And that's literally what it is. And at the moment, that's been what's happened to me. But you've got to keep fighting. And, you know, if you can keep that kind of grit between your teeth and still want to achieve stuff in football, then I'm definitely not too old yet. But hopefully I'll be full-time again one day. And if I am, I am. If I'm not, then I'm not. That's what it is.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to suggest, you know, you mentioned Perry NG's gone to Cardiff. Billy Jones has gone back to Rotherham. You know, get on the phone to Dave, see if he wants a right back that
can compete with Travis Johnson. Yeah, well, you know what? I was going to, I seen that Billy had gone back the other day, and I was going to write on the crew on the Twitter account, my league's been stopped, you know, and then put the eyes or something. And I thought, you know, ring David if he'll let me come and train or something, because I know for a fact that I could still do a job. So, but again, it's just embarrassing myself. But I should ring him really and just say, like, listen, just let me come in and I'll show you for a week that I'm up to the level.
Work for Dougie.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but he's a bit younger, maybe. I don't know.
So. I'll tell you something else as well, Matt. You mentioned before, if we asked any Notts County fan, that they would say that you're a legend. If you ask any Crewe fan, they would say exactly the same thing, mate.
Yeah, no, and I know that, and I do know that as well. And that's why what I said before about when I left Crewe, it really hurt me, because I think a lot of Crewe fans overall would say that I was a good servant, and I just hated the one club that I've been at where I achieved a lot. That I didn't leave with kind of a hero's kind of exit, but that's been tough for me. So I'm glad that I've been able to come on and kind of say that it wasn't the way it seemed at all. And just to kind of have a platform to kind of say to people, like, listen, Crewe has basically given me my career. Like, if I didn't go to Crewe that day when I was 11, like, then I wouldn't be sat here now at all. Like, and even I wouldn't be sat on any podcast, because if I didn't go to Crewe, I wouldn't have gone anywhere. So I'll always love Crewe, and, you know, I've spent 14 years of my career at Crewe, and that'll always be somewhere that I'll want to go back to, and I want to go and see what's the game. And I'll always have them as one of my first clubs I look at on Sky Sports News, like, all the time.
I don't know which Crewe fans were messaging your abuse when you left, but I've never really heard anyone say a bad word about you. You know, if, for what it's worth, I think you were my mum's favourite player when you were at the club. So, you know
what's mad? I'm always everyone's mum's favourite, you know. And I don't know why that is, but yeah.
I have no idea. I'll ask her next time I speak to her.
Yeah, but find out.
Thank you so much for coming on. And thank you so much for speaking so honestly and so openly and for giving us this time. You know, I think we've been on for... It might not be this long when we make the edit, but it's over slightly over 2 hours you've been on now. So thank you so much for that.
Sound nice one, lads. Thanks a lot for having me. It's been good.
Tim and Aaron, thank you so much for coming on as well.
Cheers.
Yeah, nice one, lads.
And thank you for listening. Until our next podcast, goodbye. Bomb, 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 dang, 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 ding, dong, ding, blue moon.